I'm Allison Keyes. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. Coming up, tomorrow sees primary elections in a handful of potentially bellwether states, including Arizona, as we look to the November midterm election. Arizona's tough anti-illegal immigration law was stayed by a judge last month, but a major supporter of those measures, John McCain, is looking strong in his Senate battle. We'll talk about his once-tight race and that of the son of former Vice President Dan Quayle, who's tangling with an African-American Republican. That's in just a few minutes. But first, we look to the primaries in Florida, where campaigning has been as boisterous as spring break. The contests for Senate and governor both have wealthy candidates pouring cash into their campaigns, yet trailing their opposition. A major point in Florida is that Republican-turned-independent Governor Charlie Crist isn't running for governor this time. He is, as you may know, running for Senate. Joining us from Miami, we have reporter Phil Latzman on the line with us. Thanks, Phil, for joining us.
Allison, my pleasure.
Let's start out with the Senate race. You've got Democratic Congressman Kendrick Meek, who is trying to become the first black senator from Florida. His opponent, Jeff Green, is a billionaire real estate developer who spent about $23 million of his own dollars on the campaign, and he's never before held office. How's that contest looking?
Well, for a while, it was looking like Jeff Green, a billionaire who was once a Republican, once lived in California and ran for office and came here and made his money on shorting the real estate market and has spent some of his billions on campaign ads, many millions of it, was leading Kendrick Meek by a significant margin in the past couple of weeks. That has changed, and Congressman Meek has regained his lead. In fact, there's a new poll that's out just on the eve of the election, which shows Congressman Meek up 39 to 29% over Jeff Green for that Democratic Senate nomination. So right now, it looks like experience is overtaking money in at least the Democratic Senate race.
What turned it around?
I think that there's been a lot of allegations against Jeff Green related to debauchery, related to the fact that he, say, for instance, took his yacht to Cuba, and this has gotten a lot of play down here. He had said during a debate that he had taken it there on a Jewish humanitarian mission, and then he had to backtrack and say, no, it wasn't that. It was to refuel. And, of course, nobody can just go to Cuba. There are travel restrictions in place, which Congress is debating now. But he sort of made up that whole story, and there's been a lot of stories about his debaucherous ties. He had Mike Tyson as his best man at his wedding. Sort of a party boy image, and that may be catching up to him right now.
And these two have also been having a bit of, shall we say, a spat over Israel, right?
Well, it's always a big issue here, and the Jewish vote is key, especially in South Florida. And I think that Jeff Green, who is from Palm Beach, where there's a big Jewish population, has been campaigning hard in the Jewish communities, looking to take away that vote from Kendrick Meek. And Israel has come up as one of the main issues there that I think Jeff Green accuses the Meek campaign of not paying enough attention to.
Talk to us a little bit about the help that President Obama and former President Clinton have been giving to Meek, I believe. Is that a positive or a negative this year?
It's been a big positive for, I think, former President Bill Clinton is more popular down here than current President Barack Obama. No question about that. Mm-hmm. The former president was out at a rally for Kendrick Meek last Monday. They had to originally had planned for 700-800 people. They had to increase it to like a 2,000-seat venue so they could accommodate all the Clinton people. And that really, I think, has made a big difference. If any endorsement helps, it's that one that Bill Clinton said, I love Kendrick Meek, his quote exactly a week ago today. So he's gotten that big boost from Bill Clinton. But Barack Obama, who was here last week, his poll numbers are down, I think, everywhere, but especially here with unemployment at 11.5%. A lot of people are kind of frustrated. But he, I don't think, is as much a help to Kendrick Meek as Bill Clinton would be.
How is Governor Crist factoring into the primaries tomorrow? Is he just kind of waiting in the wings for the final vote in November?
He's got his hands clasped behind his head, and he's got his feet up on the desk, I think, watching the results come in, because he doesn't have to worry. Of course, back in April, he decided to become NPA, as we call it down here, no party affiliation. He's an independent. He's going to wait it out and see what happens in that Senate primary between Meek and Green, and then he's going to go after those Democratic voters, no question, in November, trying to steal them away, and he has a pretty good chance of doing that as an independent who really has championed some Democratic causes, things that have made him the enemy of the Republicans, and certainly he's closer to the Democrats right now than he is the Republicans, I would think.
What about the Tea Party candidate, Marco Rubio? He's been a little bit less strident lately, hasn't he?
Well, I mean, he's the Republican candidate, and he's also been kind of sitting back and watching all of this. And I think you'd be surprised to see how he might drift a little bit away from the Tea Party once the general election starts, and maybe he can come more to the middle. But it'll be interesting. He's been on public appearances, and he's been pretty much ignoring, I think, the primaries, the Democratic nods. I think, you know, we're just waiting for that next thing to kick in. And certainly Wednesday, when he has a chance to see who he's going against as a Democrat, he'll be a lot more vocal. We'll be hearing a lot more from the Rubio campaign.
Really briefly, what's your take on the gubernatorial race? You've got Rick Scott with his $50 million loan to his campaign running against the Florida Attorney General Bill McCollum.
Yeah, if he spent $40 million so far, I guess he might bombard the airwaves with more. This is a millionaire former healthcare executive whose company, not him personally, but his company, was fined $1.7 billion in fines by the federal government for Medicare fraud. He was exonerated and got a golden parachute, spent tons of money on TV ads attacking Bill McCollum. And you talk about Arizona. Arizona has factored in because they're trying to out-Arizona each other. One is claiming that they'll have stricter laws than Arizona when it comes to immigration, and that's what Scott's been attacking McCollum on.
Phil?
So McCollum has flip-flopped, and it's been a very interesting race.
Phil, sorry, I've got to cut you off because we actually are going to talk about Arizona in just a moment. Phil Latzman of Miami member station WLRN joined us to preview tomorrow's Florida primary elections. Excuse me. Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Allison.
Now we're going to turn to yet another sunny state, known as much for its politics as for its many retirement communities. Arizona holds its primary tomorrow as well, and it's also expected to be a little contentious. Tensions have been running high there for months. Joining us to look at just a few of tomorrow's contest is Howie Fisher of the Arizona Capital News Service. Welcome, Howie. Thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
We will get to Senator McCain in a minute, but first, let's talk about the 3rd District Congressional race just north of downtown Phoenix. There are 10 people running in this mostly urban district, and the fight for name recognition can't be pretty. But you've got Ben Quayle, the son of former Vice President Dan Quayle, and Vernon Parker, the African-American Republican candidate. What's going on with the tiff the two of them are having right now?
Well, clearly, the two of them see each other as the people to knock off, and the charges have been flying thick and heavy. For example, Vernon Parker noted that Ben Quayle had this family shot, and there were two little girls in there, and it turns out they weren't Ben's kids. They were actually his nieces, and he said they're renting a family. Meanwhile, Ben Quayle made a comment suggesting that because of Vernon's getting disciplined by the Small Business Administration, that if he gets elected, he will become the, quote, poster boy for the Democratic Party when it comes to ethical violations. Vernon, in turn, responded not on the issue of poster part, but the boy part. He said, I should have been called the poster child for the Democratic Party.
In other words, the race issue.
It's a race issue in there. Each one is spending a lot of money, and the trick is to get above that din. Ben Quayle got a lot of national attention. For example, he ran an ad calling Barack Obama the worst president ever in the entire history of the United States. And that kind of thing is designed to, you know, get attention. Now, of course, as you point out, with 10 people in the race, low turnout, somebody with a couple of thousand votes could be the next congressperson from that district, since it's heavily Republican.
Howie, is race really that much of an issue in Arizona?
Not so much here. I mean, obviously, Arizona's gotten a lot of attention over Senate Bill 1070, immigration reform, that hasn't really factored in terms of the federal contest here, at least not this one, certainly the McCain-Hayworth, if you want to talk about that. But it's simply a question of each side looking for the other's vulnerability. Vernon was mayor of Paradise Valley, which is a, shall I say, largely white, mm-hmm. affluent community, managed to get elected there. Race was never an issue. I think that it simply came up because Vernon saw an opportunity to attack Quayle, who's gotten a lot of publicity, has gotten a lot of money because of his dad's name. And Vernon figured, oh, you're going to call me poster boy? Well, I'll show you.
Sounds like the fun there continues. But let's move on to Senator McCain, who's hoping for a fifth term in office. He's up against former Congressman J.D. Hayworth, and there's a Tea Party activist named Jim Deacon. But McCain was in some trouble there for a while, wasn't he? How'd he turn things around?
Well, this has been a fascinating race where you have somebody to the right writer and rightist, I guess you'd call it that, to get to Jim Deacon, particularly over the issue of immigration. J.D. Hayworth spent 12 years in Congress, very conservative, says that McCain is not a true conservative because at one time, you may remember, he and Senator Kennedy sponsored an immigration reform bill, and that included a path to citizenship. That's the dreaded A word, amnesty. Now, McCain will deny he's ever sponsored a bill with amnesty because he said you'd have to pay a fine, you'd have to learn English, you'd have to go to the back of the line. But Hayworth was able to use that fairly effectively for a while. What happened is that an old TV infomercial surfaced, which showed J.D. as sort of a huckster, saying, you can get free money from the government. I'm former Congressman J.D. Hayworth. And John McCain has beaten about the head and ears severely on that. Now, it doesn't hurt by virtue of the fact that John McCain has $20 million and J.D. has perhaps $2 million because...
Yeah, that can't make a difference at all.
couldn't possibly. And you cannot turn on the radio in this town or watch the TV without seeing a McCain ad there. So I think J.D., absent some miracle in the next 18 to 24 hours, put a fork in him.
Howie, really briefly, what does the McCain race say about the influence of the Tea Party uprising everybody was talking about just a few months ago, and I mean briefly?
Well, obviously he's taking advantage of it to the extent that Sarah Palin came to town, his former vice presidential running mate. He says they need to be paid attention to, and obviously I see myself as a true conservative, and that's McCain's attitude.
Howie Fisher is a political reporter from Arizona's Capital News Service. He joined us today from Phoenix. Thanks so much for your insight.
You're very welcome.
I'm Allison Keyes, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michel Martin is away. Coming up, he became an internet sensation in the wake of a TV interview, in the wake of an attempted sexual assault of his sister. Antoine Dotson speaks about his newfound fame and whether his popularity cost him his dignity. But first, singer Wyclef Jean sparked a firestorm of interest when he announced plans to run for president in Haiti, but that country's election board rejected his candidacy Friday night, apparently because he didn't meet the requirement that candidates maintain 5 consecutive years of residency in Haiti prior to running. But yesterday, Jean said he isn't giving up his quest for office just yet. He says his lawyers will file an appeal, even though an election board spokesman says there's no legal mechanism for doing that. Jacqueline Charles, a reporter from the Miami Herald, has been following the situation closely and joins us now from Port-au-Prince. Hey, Jackie.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So tell us, where does this leave the election? The board accepted and rejected a number of candidates, but kind of didn't explain its reasoning for any of that, right?
I mean, here's reality. I mean, in terms of Wyclef Jean, there was a filed about 20-page document of legal documents on why he did not meet eligibility for these elections. And anyone who follows Haiti elections closely, it's no rocket science in terms of what those reasons could have been or what possibly they were. I think that ultimately, in the end, what we've seen is a very high-profile individual who was born here in Haiti, who wanted to run for elections and did not succeed. And then you saw the PR machine kicked in. But as the spokesperson for the Electoral Commission said, there is no appeals process. So even his lawyers, in announcing that they were going to appeal, they were very much aware that the decision was a final decision.
So basically, he's done.
And also have to... Yes, basically, he is done. And there are 19 candidates in this election. There will be there's an election plan for November 28th because it is a very complicated process. It's a very complicated race. And why Wyclef Jean's candidacy brought a lot of international attention to the elections, because he is no longer part of the process, along with 14 others, it does not mean that suddenly Haiti will not have elections or the elections are no more.
Jacqueline, really briefly, are there any of the other candidates that have the same cachet he does? Is there a front runner now?
Well, there's a couple of front runners. I mean, you know, the thing when you look at the 19 candidates, you have a former Jacques-Édouard Alexis, who's a former two-time prime minister under President René Préval. You've got a guy like Leslie Voltaire, who's a Cornell-educated urban planner. You have Préval's own pig, Jules Celestin, who's a Swiss-educated, you know, mechanical engineer. In the Haitian context, yes, there are front runners. But I think from the international audience, Wyclef Jean certainly had the name recognition, and he was the name that everybody recognized. And for these candidates who remain, who are now trying to win the presidency, the problem that they have is they're all going to be fishing in the same pond, more or less. They're going to be going after the same base, voter base, and that's what makes a very complicated election in the Haitian context. But there are people here like Sweet Mickey or Michel Martelly, who is a Compas star, who is the one who introduced Wyclef Jean to Haitian audiences years ago. So I think that we have to look at this from an international perspective, but also from a Haiti perspective.
Jacqueline.
That at the end of the day, whoever is elected is going to be president of Haiti.
Jacqueline, sorry, I got to cut you off. We are out of time. Jacqueline Charles is a reporter from the Miami Herald. She joined us from Haiti. Thank you much.
Thank you.
Next, we turn to a Haitian woman who's hoping to use her formidable talents to bring hope to her country. Siraj Bertin is a lawyer, she's fluent in four languages, and she's worked for the International Alliance for Haiti's Recovery. But tonight, instead of a power suit, she'll be rocking a fabulous evening dress, and she hopes a crown. Bertin is competing in the Miss Universe competition, and she's the first Miss Haiti in 22 years. She joins us now from Las Vegas. How you doing, Miss Haiti?
Hello, how are you doing? I'm great.
22 years. Wow. That's got to be kind of a great responsibility.
It is. It's an honor for me. I feel really privileged because I'm representing my country after all those years. So I'm just having fun. I'm enjoying everything, and I'm working hard to make my country feel proud of me.
Tell me how the pageant was brought back after all of that time, and how did you earn that title in a year where, you know, I mean, Haiti has been so devastated by the earthquake. How did all this happen?
Yeah, actually, I was retired from modeling since 3 years when I graduated from law school. So I was working as a lawyer. I wasn't really interested in contests or anything. But I know the importance of the Miss Universe pageant, and I believe that it's a big promotion, and it's the best way to have publicity for the country, and my country needs it. I do not know why they did the Miss Haiti exactly this year, but I thank the person that does it because it's an opportunity that they are giving to my country. And as the Miss Haiti representation, I'm going to do my best to use this opportunity to bring help to my country, to make people be interested in Haiti so they don't forget about us. And of course, we thank all the international community for their help. But things are cooling down, and people are forgetting that Haiti still needs a lot of help, and we're still not recovered yet, you know?
Yeah. I know that you've heard this before, but I have to ask it. You're a multilingual lawyer. You're 24 years old. You are so not the typical beauty pageant person. What made you decide, I want to be Miss Universe?
The reason I'm here in the contest, as I was telling you, it's because I believe that this is a way to promote my country. I want to work for Haiti. Even if I have the opportunity to meet Miss Universe, I mean, that would be great. And I know it would open a lot more doors for me, and I could find help for my country. I could be a bigger ambassador of my country. But even though if I don't win the crown, I'm going to still do the same thing. I'll just have to work harder. And the reason is that I believe that this is one step forward for Haiti. I want Haitian to participate in international competition as important as this one. It can be beauty competition, it can be artistic competition, intellectual competition. But I want people to look at my country and see that we have talent, see that we have beautiful things, and not only remember us for poverty or for crisis or for problems.
Ms. Bertin, I know that people have given you a little bit of drama for representing Haiti in this contest. I mean, you didn't grow up poor, as some of the Haitians did. There are some people that have an issue with you having grown up in the Dominican Republic, and there are even some people that have actually implied that because you are a lighter-skinned woman that you don't represent what they think the rest of Haiti looks like. I mean, how do you feel about this? Is it hurtful to hear?
No, you know, it doesn't hurt me because I know I'm doing a good job. I know I'm doing something for my country. And even those people people that are saying that if they are Haitian, I represent them also because I am Miss Haiti. And there will always have issues. There always are people that will like you, other will not. But you just have to do your job and make them feel proud. I believe that being lighter skin or not shouldn't be an issue, not these days. And, of course, they said that I'm not poor or I had a great childhood. Yes, my father worked a lot to give me good things. It is true. But who said that Miss Haiti has to be poor? Who said she has to be dark skin? I mean, I'm just doing my job. This is my title. I won it because I did my best to arrive to a name, and I did it. So people should just look what I'm doing. They cannot just come and criticize me because they believe that it should be different.
What happens after tonight's competition? Win or lose, what are you going to do to help your country?
If I win the Miss Universe contest, I will have a bigger opportunity to promote the country. I will have a bigger opportunity to find help for my country. If I don't win the Miss Universe pageant, I'm going to still work for Haiti. I'm going back to Haiti. I'm going to develop some projects because there's a lot of people since I won that have asked me how can they help my country. Well, I want to give them the opportunity to really help my country, and I'm going to do my best so they can do it all for my people.
All right. Siraj Bertin is Miss Haiti and will compete in the Miss Universe pageant. The competition airs tonight on NBC, and she was kind enough to join us from Las Vegas. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too.
Bye.
Now we open up the pages of the Washington Post magazine, something Tell Me More does just about every week, to find stories about the way we live now. You've seen the box of Lonely LPs, that's Vinyl Records for those who don't remember that, and you've seen them at the garage sale, on the sidewalk, or at the thrift store. Old, sometimes a little beat up, records full of music, popular back in the day, but now selling for just 50 cents a pop. You know what I'm talking about. I've bought my fair share and so have you. Well, we have a rather fabulous recording here that's nearly 90 years old. That's Marika Papagika, a Greek-American singer who was popular in the 1920s. Ian Nagoski knew that when he heard her, he had found something special. Nagoski is a collector of obscure music. The older and less known, the better. He then makes albums by using his discoveries, some of them so wrapped in the mist of time he doesn't even know their names or where they're from. His work is featured in this week's Washington Post magazine in a piece by freelance writer Jason Cherkis. Ian Nagoski joins us now from member station WFWM in Frostburg, Maryland. Welcome, Ian.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I have to say, when I first heard that album, I went, wow, what a cool singer, what a cool voice. How'd you find her?
Well, her records staggered into a record store that I used to have in Baltimore, Maryland. Some guys who clean out houses found a bunch of stuff left behind by a Greek fellow who had died. And I bought them just on principle, because anything that's in a language other than English, I just buy. Mm-hmm. And started listening to them over and over again. And I just got really attached to something in Marika's voice that seemed to me to be extremely special.
Almost like a haunting kind of quality.
Very, very haunting, I think. The words to that song, for instance, are deeply, deeply touching. They go, if you love me and it's a dream, in the sweet dawn, may I never wake up. So it's a song of incredible fulfillment and yearning almost simultaneously.
Did you already know about her when you picked up the music, or did you learn after you looked her up?
No, I didn't have the slightest idea who she was or what she was. There was very little information forthcoming. And so I started trying to dig around and find out as much as I could about her, and really eventually got pretty obsessed.
And she's not the first discovery of that sort you've made. Talk about how long you've been looking for music like this.
I don't think I've ever not gone looking for music that was unusual. Records have really been my primary education throughout my life.
Why do you think music, obscure music, I guess, in particular, has been such a calling for you, something that's so visceral for you?
Well, it's a whole way of understanding the world or of expanding one's understanding. So in the case of Marika, for instance, the fact that she is such a great singer, made so many records, was so immensely popular, and yet has been written out of the history of American music, basically. I mean, here she was in New York City, made 225 records in 10 years, and, you know, you could only find three sentences about her online. It just seemed to me to be a real mystery why she had been written out like that.
Which is really interesting. But you know what? We actually wanted to play another example of something you've found. I believe this is M. Dojin. See, that's a different kind of cool. And I understand you don't even know this person's first name.
I don't. I guess that he might be a guy named Herant Dujan, who immigrated through Ellis Island, but I really don't know. I have gone about systemically contacting everyone with that last name in the United States and have actually not yet heard back from a single person. So if anybody out there knows who this M. Dujan is, gee, I'd love to know. It's a blazing, blazing performance. He's a fabulous oud player and was living in New York City and sort of operating in the same social musical world as Marika, of the diaspora of the Ottoman Empire. Dujan was Armenian and was playing in a kind of scene of Armenians and Greeks and Syrians and just great, great musicians in the scene that has not been particularly well documented or thought about. I'm not saying it's Storyville in New Orleans, but there were a lot of really good musicians, and they recorded prolifically. Fabulous stuff.
I believe I read in part of the article you were talking about how some of the immigrant music that you had been hearing had been kind of almost erased from the American musical scene.
Well, it's an interesting question how it is that music in languages other than English in the United States doesn't get included in the story that we tell ourselves of what America's musical landscape is like.
So it's like a DNA strand that's missing big chunks.
Yeah, I think so. And I think there's a political element to it, which is sort of interesting as well, this business of being an immigrant. You know, nowadays we have all of these people coming from South Asia, West Africa, Central and South America. And there is a question of, you know, are we going to insist that immigrants live this life of, you know, incredibly brutally hard work and becoming capital A American, leaving behind and throwing behind their own culture and their own language as fast as possible? Or is there another way to go?
That is a whole nother conversation. But let me ask you one other question. I know back in 2007, you made an album with some of the artists you had found, including the fabulous Marika. What kind of reception did it get? And is there a market for this kind of found sound, especially in light of what you were just saying?
I think the people were intrigued by the pieces on that disc, which is called Black Mirror. One of the reasons that people paid any attention to it at all was because it came out on a label out of Atlanta, Georgia, called Dust Digital, which had already gained a reputation as, you know, a really, really important conduit for American music. And I felt very, very fortunate that that label chose to put out what basically was a kind of like greatest hits from my record collection. And people liked it, and I'm very proud of it.
Ian Nagoski, a music collector and self-described historian, a lover of sound in all its many forms, crackly, obscure, mysterious, found sound. Thanks for joining us and taking us on such a musical journey.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Allison Keyes. Michelle Martin is away. He became a worldwide sensation thanks to YouTube. For 24-year-old Antoine Dotson, it all started when he rescued his sister from an apparent sexual assault and was interviewed as part of a local TV story on WAFF in Huntsville, Alabama.
Kelly Dodson was asleep with a little girl inside their apartment on Webster Drive when
I was attacked by some idiot from out here in the projects.
Dodson struggled with her attacker, knocking over items in her bedroom. Antoine Dodson heard his sister scream and ran to help.
Well, obviously we have a rapist in Lincoln Park. He's climbing in your windows. He's snatching your people up, trying to rape them. So y'all need to hide your kids, hide your wife, and hide your husband because they're raping everybody out here.
The video of the TV story was posted on YouTube and earned millions of views thanks to Antoine's rant against the attacker. Then a band called the Gregory Brothers fashioned a song from the video called the Bed Intruder Rap, and even though it seems to mock Mr. Dodson, the band promised to share the proceeds with him.
He's climbing in your windows, he's snatching your people up, trying to rape them, so y'all need to hide your kids, hide your wife, hide your kids, hide your wife, hide your kids, hide your wife, and hide your husband, because they're raping everybody out here. You don't have to come and confess. We're looking for you.
Dodson is also selling t-shirts. He's asking for donations, and he created MyFanLine.com, a site where the public can reach out to him. The Antoine Dodson phenomenon doesn't sit well with some African Americans, though, and we'll talk with a technology and social media expert and with a cultural commentator in a couple of minutes. But we decided we'd reach out to Antoine, too. He joins us now from WLRH in Huntsville, Alabama. Welcome, Antoine.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I have to start out, though, on a much more serious note. Talk to us a little bit about the assault itself and your family's reaction. Is everybody okay?
Yeah, it's been 3 weeks. Everybody is okay. We're dealing with it day by day, but we're getting a lot of smiles out of the family, so it's getting back to normal.
Has your sister or the rest of your family gotten counseling? Have you guys had to talk to anybody, or are you just kind of working through it on your own?
Actually, like, we have been in similar situations, never when somebody come into our window or whatever, but we just deal with it on our own. You know, we talk to each other and try to comfort each other, and that's the best way we know how to deal with stuff like this.
So your family's having to deal with the aftermath of this really frightening attack, and then these videos happen. I mean, there are more than 10 million hits on one of them. There were 4 million hits on the TV news story alone. I mean, what on earth did you think about that?
I know, I was like really tripping because, you know, I have done like interviews on the news before or whatever, but it was about a child who had got hit by a car and she ended up passing. And so I was telling them that they should put like, what you call them, speed bumps in the street to keep people from speeding so fast, you know, in the projects or whatever. And that didn't do nothing. And then when this happened, I was like, wow, I can't believe it went crazy like this. Like, everybody seen the video. It was amazing.
Were you surprised? I mean, are people stopping you on the street, shaking your hand?
Yes, everywhere I go. Everywhere I go, is somebody stopped. Hey, you're the YouTube guy, or you're Antoine. Oh, you're my hero. And that's pretty cool when people can sit and say, you're a hero. You know, like, that's really cool.
Do you feel like a hero?
Not really, because I always protect my sisters, and I have brothers too, so I protect them too. I'm the oldest of six, so it's pretty much a daily job for me.
Big brother in the house. How do you feel, by the way, about the video, the Gregory Brothers, who produced that music video of you and your sister's words?
Well, you know, the guy haven't been caught yet, but us hearing that video, it had gave us some type of happiness. It gave us some type of comfort, because out of this all, that video, we really liked it. Like, it was really cool, especially to hear our voice on the track. And, you know, it's on iTunes and everything. That was really cool, and it did bring some happiness.
You know, there are some folk that might think you're being exploited or that people are making fun of you. What do you think about people that think that?
I mean, there's nothing you can do about it. People are going to talk and people are going to say stuff. I'm a joker anyway. Like, me and my family, we play jokes on each other all the time, so basically, you know, people going to talk. They can say what they want. It's not going to change us.
There were also some people that called the actual TV station and basically said that you were being portrayed kind of like a character of African Americans. And some people have said the same thing about the videos. Do you think they're wrong or right?
I mean, I know that people probably, in it for the wrong reason, they're trying to make fun of it. But you know what I'm saying? It's sad that people have so much negative to say about the situation, because this is a serious matter, but people are going to talk. We can't stop them from talking.
So as far as you're concerned, race is not an issue in what's going on here?
Not at all. Not to me and my family.
All right. So how has your life changed after these events? I was hearing that you guys are getting ready to make a move.
Yeah, so far my life changed. Like, I never in my life done radio before, so it's like now ever since this happened, we getting all these radio shows, and I have did this commercial or whatever for First Family Mortgage. So it's like cool. A lot of opportunities is coming. We just trying to get everything on the table and discuss everything so I don't make no crazy choices.
With all the fame and fortune being thrown your way, so are you going to pack up and move to the Big Apple or out to L.A.? Or shall we see you on the big screen sometime?
Hopefully that'd be nice, and I would love to come to a big city because I'm from a big city myself, so I like the fast life. I'm not going to lie.
I'm shocked to hear that. What are you hoping to accomplish out of your fan line?
I just hope that I can comfort people because most of the people that I talk to and interact with, it's people who have been in similar situations or been a victim of rape, and I just want to comfort them and give them a couple of, you know, ways that I have dealt with the situation. So basically, I'm trying to be an inspiration to people.
What's your sister think about all of this?
At first, she hated it. She was like, Kevin, they're trying to make a fool out of you. Just let it go. Don't even worry about it. But I was like, Kelly, this could be an opportunity for our family to get out of the hood. You know what I'm saying? So I took it and I was running with it, and I'm still running with it.
All right. Just one last question, Antoine. Besides your helping to inspire rape victims, what are you hoping to get out of this for yourself? What's your goal, do you think?
I would like to write, you know, do writing. I love to write. That's like a passion for me. And I would like to step out into the fashion world. You know, like I'm into shoes and clothes and accessories. I love stuff like that. Like, I want to be there.
Huntsville, Alabama resident Antoine Dotson says he is supporting his family with the money and fame he's received from a YouTube video that railed against the bed intruder who broke into his house and tried to rape his sister. He was kind enough to join us from WLRH in Huntsville, Alabama. Thanks, Antoine, for being on the program.
Thank you so much for having me. Take care.
As we just heard, Antoine Dotson's rise to fame on YouTube has brought him a T-shirt line, a Facebook fan page, and now even a telephone line dedicated to some of his most ardent supporters. But as we said, not everyone has been jumping on the Antoine Dotson bandwagon. Some were disturbed by the news story in which he was featured, feeling that it reinforced racial stereotypes and perpetuated those stereotypes to a much, much wider audience as the video went viral. We wanted to get a sense of just what YouTube stardom means in today's social media savvy world, and also where Antoine Dotson can be placed in our current canon of YouTube stars popping into the email boxes across the nation. Joining us to talk about it is Mario Armstrong. He's a regular technology commentator on Tell Me More in NPR, and he also blogs about technology at marioarmstrong.com. Also joining us today is Baratunde Thurston, a comedian, author, and self-described vigilante pundit. Thank you both, gentlemen, for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Mario, let me start with you.
Okay.
Just how long does your 15 minutes of fame last these days?
That's a good question, because everyone's certainly seeking to get it. To me, everyone is a brand out there. So some people, I think, are better at leveraging their brand than others. The key to this whole thing of whether or not you could be successful off of doing a series or a YouTube video is whether you have some type of sustainability and whether you can really kind of parlay that, maybe flip that moment into multiple product lines or multiple sustainable revenue streams. So I think it takes a certain level of business savvy. Otherwise, you just become a form of entertainment with no monetization behind it. And eventually, that flame will probably die out.
What is it, Mario, that people are into? Is it quirky? Is it just people wide-eyed at the spectacle? I mean, what's catching people's eyes out there?
Yeah, I mean, you know it's all about quirkiness for sure. People like anything outside of the normal. People love to see things that they aren't exposed to. So I think this definitely has that element. I also think that things that are attached to anything that's current or anything in pop culture that's really trending fast, but things that are also heart-wrenching or causing a type of movement for a certain reason, but then also just being funny or hilarious. Those are just some of the things that I think can make a video go viral.
Baratunde, let me turn to you for a second. As I said earlier, not everybody is jumping on Antoine's Facebook fan page. What is it about him that strikes a nerve, particularly with middle-class African-Americans in Huntsville?
Well, I think when you look at the very first video that came out, it was sort of an unauthorized upload of the news clip Raw. And the headline on that clip was not, you know, local man calls out area rapist. It was something along the lines of, look, this is so funny. And
oh, no.
It completely undermined the seriousness of the content of that video. And then you saw a lot of people mocking Antoine in their knockoffs. You know, the Gregory Brothers thing was actually pretty hot. That's one of the best beats I've heard in a while. But when you look at, you see white people putting Afro wigs on and do-rags and trying to talk like they think Antoine's talking, it's just highly uncomfortable. And for a lot of black people who I know and many of others who I've read online, it was just a little too close to home for people who've never really had control of their media image, have always been defined by someone who wanted to paint a very specific, narrow picture of what black people are like. Antoine got a bit close to that for them.
What was interesting, though, a lot of those videos seemed to be pretty rainbow. I mean, it was everybody, black people, Latino people, white people.
Well, yeah, I mean, the beauty of it is Antoine did a lot of amazing things in that interview. And there's a great website run by a woman, Dr. Goddess. She's drgoddess.blogspot.com. She did a lot more research and found out it was Antoine's family that actually called the news. The police never responded. They had been waiting for a while, so they called up the news folk who, they were shocked, actually came to cover it. And as you heard in the interview just now, he has talked about, you know, crime in his community before. Mm-hmm. So he is a very compelling figure. And even in the interview, he sounds sweet and loving and conscious of everything that's happening. I think he tapped into something universal in all of us that gets outraged when some sort of injustice goes down. And the fact that he spoke out against it so soon is also rare in cases of sexual assault. He was defending his family. Mm-hmm. He was calling out his perpetrator. So there's a lot to love about what he did.
Mario, why do you think people care what Antoine Dotson says to a reporter at a tiny TV station in Huntsville?
The community at large that's watching YouTube, I don't know that community cared about why he was meeting with the local reporter. I think it goes back to what Baratunde was saying. It's more about, you know, look at this funny video. You already heard him talk about how, you know, the police do not show up. They don't mm-hmm. respond. And he's kind of become this local activist that takes things into his own hands. So I think it became something that people cared about once it became something that could be seen as maybe a parody or being used in some type of entertainment fashion. But as Baratunde mentioned, I totally agree with him that the raw content, the raw issue was being overpassed. I mean, it wasn't being seen for what the real issue was. It was transforming into something that he couldn't even stop. He couldn't stop the train. And I think that's what got people excited. So I do think it comes down to people wanting to watch something that they think is funny, not something that they think is a real serious issue.
And I'd love to tag on to something Mario said earlier about why this video was so interesting to folks. And you said something like, you know, they're seeing something they're not exposed to. And I think therein lies the attraction and some potential problems. I know that not everybody who's watching the Antoine video, either the remix auto-tune version or the original, is explicitly trying to get their ghetto fix on because they don't have it in their daily lives. But some are. And there's a history there that must be acknowledged that, you know, we still have a relatively experience-based divided nation. And so when you are able to kind of dip your toe into someone else's life, and that first reaction being like, oh, ha-ha, that's so funny, that's a bit problematic.
So, Baratunde, does that mean he deserves congratulations for taking advantage of this movement and making it mean something monetarily to their family or scorn or something in between? What do you think?
That is absolutely. I mean, I have a lot of feelings about this video, but the more I have followed Antoine on Twitter and Facebook, the more admiration I have for him, because I think collectively, if you want to make this about race, and there's also an element of sexuality in this, there's a Southern thing going on, there's a lot of things happening in this story. But if you want to look at the race angle and the quote-unquote embarrassment factor, I think what he's been able to do by grabbing control of his own meme and identity and really riding the wave and helping direct it and extracting money from it and getting his family out of the hood is the story that collectively many black people have not been able to do. You know, we still have questions of representations of ourselves in the media and who's a news executive and who's a producer and who's an editor at an organization. And Antoine, who was initially not a part of this at all, he didn't upload the first video, he didn't make the mix, this was all without his permission, said, okay, I see. Here's my T-shirt. Here's my website. Here's my new song. And so he has taken control where many of us collectively have not necessarily been able to. And I think that is a testament to the times we live in, the technology we have, and who he is as a person who's savvier than many expected.
I'm glad that you said that, because, Mario, I wanted to know, could this have happened at any other time than now?
No, I don't believe so. In my opinion, absolutely not. And this goes back to the earlier point where I said everyone truly is a brand. Whether you want to be a brand or not, you are representing something. You're representing a style, a look, a cause. You're representing something. And in this case, Antoine may not have known what he was really ultimately representing. And I think, you know, he's representing several different things all at the same time. He's representing justice. He's representing getting out of poverty. He's representing the idea that you can take control of your image to some degree, at least not just stand by and let it happen, but decide to flip it, decide to monetize it and participate and take it to the next level. And I have no problem with anybody legally trying to flip their way out of the hood. So, no, I respect his ability, and I really hope that he can really make some smart decisions to really figure out how he can not only flip this monetarily, but also continue the civic cause, the activism that I think he represents to a lot of young people that can really inspire a generation.
Wait a second. I want to ask you both a question. Mario first. Is it problematic for you that most people, I mean, almost 95% of the people seem to be more laughing at him than with him?
That's a tough one. Yeah, it bothers me. Absolutely, it bothers me because, you know, it's still, you know, it takes me back. You know, I'm not too young that I don't remember what my parents would talk about in terms of stereotypes on television. Mm-hmm. I'm not too old that I don't remember, you know, seeing blackface and things of that nature. So I have an absolute sensitivity to it. So that's why I'm saying it's imperative that someone like Antoine takes this fire and takes this momentum and turns this into something as positive as possible.
Well, gentlemen, we've got to end it there on the radio today, but you know the conversation never ends on Tell Me More. Go to the program page at npr.org and click on Tell Me More. Baratunde Thurston is a comedian, author, and self-described vigilante pundit. He joined us from our New York bureau. Mario Armstrong is a regular technology commentator here on Tell Me More, and he also blogs about technology at marioarmstrong.com. He joined us from member station WEAA in Baltimore. Thank you, gentlemen, for your thoughts.
Thank you.
Thank you, Allison.
And that's our program for today. I'm Allison Keyes, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.